Brought to you by the Royal Society of Chemistry, this is the Chemistry World Podcast.
This month, printing sugars to engineer organs, an amino acid causing changes in your brain, the rebuilding of the OXO wall, and success in the fight for open access publishing. Plus, on the subject of battles, help is at hand for those trying to kick the habit.
If your average smoker in England tries to stop, 3% success rate. And the other end of the spectrum, which is behavioural support, plus using one of the medications, such as nicotine replacement therapy, you can boost that to 30%.
Robert West will be explaining the secret to that success later in the programme. Hello, I'm Meera Senthilingam, and with me for this August edition of the Chemistry World podcast are Laura Howes, Philip Broadwith, and Phil Robinson.
The Chemistry World podcast is brought to you by the Royal Society of Chemistry. Look us up online at chemistryworld.org.
And we're kicking off this month with some antisocial behaviour. Laura?
So I'm going to be talking about some very antisocial amino acids, specifically phenylalanine. High levels of phenylalanine can cause the problems in a genetic disease called phenylketonuria. You might see sometimes when you drink soft drinks, especially diet ones, that it says it's a source of phenylalanine. That's because people with phenylketonuria, when they get large amounts of this amino acid building up, it can cause all sorts of problems in their brains, for example, and learning problems.
What effect has it been shown for this to have on the body?
So sufferers of phenylketonuria lack an enzyme that breaks down this amino acid, so it builds up. And then it goes into the blood and your sort of spinal fluid in your brain. It can cause organ damage, seizures and learning disabilities.
And so what's really been the finding here and who's been working on this?
Okay, so this is work from a group led by Ehud Gazit at the Tel Aviv University in Israel. And he was actually looking at what happens when there are large amounts of this amino acid together. They found a really interesting discovery. If you think back to things like Alzheimer's disease and Parkinson's, those are associated with what we call fibrils or amyloid fibrils, which are these sort of clumps of proteins that form and form horrible things that then stick in your brain and can cause problems. What Gazit and colleagues have found is that you can actually get the same thing with just the one amino acid, with this phenylalanine amino acid. It can form these fibrils on its own.
In the brain?
Yeah, in the brain, in the spinal fluid. They haven't actually, I think, looked at parts of the brain. At the moment, this is just sort of looking at what happens when you get high concentrations of this amino acid. And definitely this could lead to new treatments for the disease. If you can work out what's causing it, then potentially you can try and fight it.
Have they mentioned what they will be doing next with the finding?
I think what they're going to look at is to see whether other amino acids might do this, seeing whether it could be involved in other amyloid diseases. And obviously this has a lot of applications for not just phenylketonuria, but things like Alzheimer's and Parkinson's disease, which are associated with the same fibrils. But I think it's just really, really interesting that these fibrils can grow when it's just a single amino acid rather than peptides, which is what we thought before.
And away from proteins to metals now and the bonds that metals form, specifically the OXO wall, Phil, and how something's actually been corrected here or something's been proven to be wrong.
That's right. So you mentioned the OXO wall there, Meera, and that refers to a kind of rule of chemistry that governs the way in which metals bond to oxygen. And we're talking specifically here about the transition metals. So those are the metals that sort of sit in the middle of the periodic table, sometimes called the D block as well. So for members of that series and the early part of that series, as you progress across the periodic table, they form these terminal oxygen bonds very easily, in contrast to bridging bonds, where you would have an oxygen atom bonded to two metal centres, creating a bridge between them. So this is just an oxygen atom bonded to a single metal atom. For later members of the series, they don't form these bonds because of the electron density around the atom, effectively. Very simply, as you progress along the period, you have more electrons around the central metal atom. And as the oxygen comes in, it wants to donate electrons into a bond with that metal. So the more electrons you have around the metal to begin with, the less likely that's going to happen. You can have repulsion between those electrons. So for the later members of the series, you don't see these complexes being formed.
And so what's really new here? So because this has been known for some time that this happens on either side of this wall.
Yeah, absolutely. This is a classic chemistry rule, the Oxo wall. But back in 2004, a chap called Craig Hill at Emory University in Atlanta in the US, in collaboration with people around the world, actually, they claimed that they'd broken this rule. They'd broken the Oxo wall and they'd managed to create terminal oxygen bonds with platinum, which is one of these late transition metals. And he then went on in subsequent years to prove it for palladium and gold, all members of this late transition series and all apparently breaking this fundamental rule of chemistry.
But unfortunately now he's found that that wasn't actually correct.
That's right. Craig admits himself that he was always sceptical about these results, and the community at large was always very sceptical at this because it was such a well-known, long-standing rule. But as Craig says himself, he was among them. He was always a bit sceptical about these results. So over the years, even as they've been continuing to try to do this, they've been analysing their own results. And this year, they've come out with a paper that in fact says, we were wrong. We didn't form those complexes. And in fact, the Oxo wall stands.
And what really happened for them to see that this wasn't correct? So how did they manage to think they had the bonds before and now they suddenly see that they didn't?
Okay, well, the precise ins and outs of it involves, it looks like, some quite heavy data crunching. They got huge amounts of data to support their evidence in the first place. But what they thought they had previously, now on new analysis, where they thought they had platinum or gold or palladium in the complexes, it turns out that in most cases it was actually tungsten that was part of the ligands, the other ligands that were surrounding the metal. So, in fact, the Oxo wall rule was being adhered to all along.
And so what now, that they've seen that their earlier papers were, in fact, incorrect?
So, as well as publishing this new paper, they've also taken the decision to retract all of the previous papers as well, in the interests of science, so that people aren't misled or confused by them, and only allow the current paper to stand.
Okay, so just taking us back almost in time to when the Oxo wall stood.
Exactly. Erecting the Oxo wall once more.
Thank you, Phil. Now, from the rebuilding of walls to the building of a large-scale science facility, a neutron source, offering structural insight no other institution can provide, using nothing more than a beam of neutrons. Andrew Harrison is the director of the Institut Le Langevin in France, and explains why this subatomic particle is so useful.
Neutrons have a number of attributes that make them important. First and foremost, the fact that the neutrons produced in our reactor have, although they're regarded as particles, they also have associated with them a wavelength. And the wavelength of the neutrons we produce is comparable to the spacing between atoms. So just as X-rays are scattered by materials to tell you about the nuclear structure of those materials, so neutrons are scattered by materials. So that in a sense, they're a complementary technique to X-rays.
So yes, people are used to using, say, X-rays to probe things, which perhaps are slightly cheaper and more widely available. But what does a neutron source offer, say, that's better than an X-ray?
The first is the fact that the strength of the scattering of a neutron by an element is not a very strong function of its mass. You know that X-rays are scattered strongly or absorbed strongly by very heavy elements. You see that in radiography. You know, when you pass X-rays through a person, for example, you see the bones picked out against the relatively less dense flesh. And heavy objects, as you know, or heavy elements, shield or block X-rays. Metals, lead, for example, acts as a very good screen for X-rays. By contrast, neutrons are scattered to a similar degree, not the same degree, but a similar degree by heavy and light elements. And that means you can determine the positions and learn quite a lot about the properties of light elements. So if you want to understand where the protons are in the material, whether it's in a biological system or whether it's in the material that's designed for hydrogen storage and then combination of hydrogen with other elements to make energy, neutrons are an extremely good tool at pinning down precisely where those light elements are. A second feature that neutrons have is, as neutral particles, they penetrate very deeply inside materials. So you can look at structure of part of, for example, a complicated engineering component. many centimeters below the surface in conditions where X-rays would simply be absorbed and wouldn't be able to penetrate. And then there are two other features unique to neutrons. The first is that the neutron has a small magnetic moment. It behaves, if you like a little compass needle. Therefore, the way in which neutrons are scattered by materials also tells you about the magnetic structure of those materials. And it's fair to say that neutrons tell us almost everything we know in detail about magnetic structure at an atomic level. And that involves looking at the fundamental properties of magnets, but also looking at where the structure of components of real functional magnetic materials, such as the multi-layers you have in magnetic recording media or the materials you use in the magnetic recording head. And then the final feature of neutrons that distinguish it from X-rays is that the neutrons that we produce after moderation in the reactor are relatively low in energy. And that means that by measuring the changes in energy as they pass through a material, you can look at the excitations in that material. In other words, you can use neutrons to perform spectroscopy on materials. And that gives us a very useful complement to techniques such as infrared and Raman spectroscopy. And again, of course, you know, infrared and Raman spectroscopic tools are much, much cheaper. They're much more abundant. But because neutrons, again, have certain unique properties compared to optical spectroscopy, they find themselves used in situations where they really only provide the appropriate tool. And I'll give you one example. If you want to look at the transformation of molecules in a working catalyst, one of the tools you can use to do that is to follow the, if you like, the vibrational fingerprint, or in the form of the spectrum, the vibrational spectrum of that molecule. And that's often very difficult to do with optical spectroscopic techniques if the medium on which those molecules are supported is very opaque to that radiation. Neutrons, by contrast, penetrate very effectively most materials. So you can actually image molecules in the middle of a porous catalyst or on the surface of a dirty working catalyst.
And what's the source material that you're using to create the neutrons in the first place?
So we at the heart of our reactor is uranium-235. So it's a conventional fission reaction, not unlike that you'd find in a conventional power reactor.
And I guess, as is the case with X-rays and X-ray diffraction as well, is the possibilities and the types of, say, materials analysed, is that quite diverse? And so is this quite a versatile technology?
Absolutely. I mean, we support work from about 2,000 scientists across Europe every year, and they bring materials in every area of science. So, you know, we support chemical crystallographers, we support polymer chemists, we support people who look at biological membranes and biological macromolecules, engineers, people who are developing alloys for containment in nuclear fusion. Every field where you need to know the structure of the material or the magnetic structure of the material or the vibrational character, particularly of solids, is amenable to neutron scattering.
And could you give an example, say, of something that has been looked at more recently at the facility and a finding perhaps that's resulted from it?
Yes. For example, at the moment, we have several groups of scientists who want to develop better polymer electrolytes for use in fuel cells. And the function of a polymer electrolyte, among other things, relates to the ability of water charged species to move through the membrane as a battery is discharging. Some of the experiments we're performing actually allow you to look at the dynamics of molecular transport in a real polymer electrolyte in a working battery as the chemical reaction proceeds. And again, the beauty of the technique is that because neutrons are penetrating, you can look at a precise region of a material in a working environment.
And I guess, as you've touched on, that the aim is to see these kind of dynamic structures in order to understand more and therefore advance these things further, so to develop better fuel cells and so on.
Absolutely. And I think one thing that's changed is, you know, 20, 30, 40 years ago, a facility such as ours or facilities that supported X-ray diffraction were more about looking at static structures, you know, looking at trying to understand a lump of material in a particular state. Increasingly, as sources get brighter, as the techniques develop, we can look at the evolution of structure, and we can look at systems. The vogue phrase at the moment is in operando, you know, real working dynamic systems, looking at the evolution of structure throughout a chemical or materials process.
Andrew Harrison. Now, what would you do to make science available to all? Enabling a world where everyone can access whichever scientific information or papers they wish with ease. It seems what it takes to achieve such a feat is some politicians, policymakers, and a large influential funding body. Philip?
Yes, Mira, the debate about open access publishing has been going on for quite a long time, but there's been quite a few developments in the last month that have really brought it to the fore in terms of political and scientific discussion.
Well, let's take a step back, first of all, and just discuss the whole concept of open access.
OK, Mira, well, what open access basically means is that research findings that generally have been paid for by public funds should be available to anybody who wants to read them. That sounds like a kind of obvious thing, but most journals charge a subscription fee to read the research. Now, if you don't want to do that, there are various ways of getting around it. One option, which is called green open access, is for researchers to publish their research in the normal way in journals that charge a subscription, but after a certain time, generally between 6 months and a year, they would then deposit the paper in a central repository or one that's run by their university, which would then make it available online on the web in its entirety to anyone who wants to read it. The other option, which is what's called gold open access, is that a fee is paid to the publisher, and whether that comes directly from the researcher or from their funder or whatever is something that needs to be worked out, but the fee is paid on publication and the publisher themselves makes the article available for free on the internet through their own website.
And so what's happened more recently in this area? Because this is a long-standing debate.
OK, well, at the end of last year, David Willetts, the Minister for Universities and Science, commissioned Dame Janet Finch and a working group to examine the different possibilities for open access to UK research. They put out their report last month, and the general finding was that, yes, the UK researchers should pursue open access publishing. They should make their research available, and that the most sustainable route to do that, from the point of view of both the publishers, the researchers and the funders, would be to follow the gold open access model.
But I guess with such changes and recommendations, there is going to be some kind of fee or cost associated with this.
Well, yes, Mira, and that comes in kind of two aspects. There's quite a big cultural shift to go from the kind of status quo of publishing to a more open access mindset. And that shift is happening a lot more in the biomedical sciences, but not and physics to a certain extent, but not so much in chemistry. So there will need to be a more cultural shift in the chemistry community. But there's also a financial burden. The Finch report estimates that the total cost to the UK higher education as a whole could be in the region of £50 to £60 million a year. Certainly not a small fee, but there are potential mechanisms in place to find that money from somewhere.
And so, Phil, the Wellcome Trust have also been getting involved in this area and this debate recently.
That's right. So the Wellcome Trust are one of the UK's biggest funders of research. And in fact, they've supported open access publishing for some time. They actually have a policy. Anyone who's funded by the Wellcome Trust, the research that they do, has to be made available within 6 months after it's been published. But now the Wellcome Trust are kind of cracking down, or they're tightening up this rule, because while they apply this rule to anyone who's funded by them, it's not often abided by. So, in fact, almost half the research that is funded is not openly available, in fact. So what the Wellcome Trust has now said is that for anyone who's failing to do this, they're going to be penalised, and they'll have a portion of their grant withheld. And also, in the future, people submitting grants to the Wellcome Trust, any publications that they have that are not in open access journals will not be considered as part of the grant application.
When are they planning on enforcing this?
Well, with immediate effect. So this starts with papers published in 2009. So if you did it before that, then you seem to have got off the hook. But from 2009 onwards, all papers that still are behind paywalls, they'll need to sort that out. Otherwise, you won't get your money.
And so this really should help most journals kind of go this way.
It's another incentive. Yeah, exactly, to push the open access model.
And what about moving outside of the UK and into Europe, Laura?
Yeah, so not only is the Wellcome Trust obviously now enforcing its open access rules, but we've had news from Europe that actually the European Commission is planning to make all of its research that it's going to be funding through a programme called Horizon 2020. That pot is 80 billion euros worth of research. And it would like all of its research that it funds through that programme to also be put through either gold or green open access. They don't specify which. They leave it up to the researcher. And presumably at the moment they say that they haven't got a massive pot of money for funding the gold open access that Philip was talking about. But certainly that's another push for researchers and for publishers, which possibly would have happened anyway, but maybe needed a kick. And this may be it.
You're listening to the Chemistry World podcast with me, Meera Senthilingam. Still to come, we're piecing the puzzle together to create new forms of graphene and printing out sugars to build artificial organs. But first, a helping hand for the millions of smokers trying to kick the habit. Smoking causes 5 million deaths globally each year from smoking-related diseases. But despite many smokers wanting to quit, over 70% of those that try fail to fight their addiction. Robert West from University College London explains why.
One can use the term nicotine addiction, but it's a bit of an oversimplification. Ultimately, if the cigarettes didn't have nicotine in them, no one would smoke them. But just like with any kind of drug or even behavioural addiction, there's more to it than that. Nicotine acts in many different ways in the brain to keep people smoking. One of them is that after repeated ingestion of nicotine, there is an alteration in part of the brain chemistry, which means that if the nicotine levels become depleted, like overnight, for example, or when you're trying to stop smoking, smokers experience what you might call a nicotine hunger. It's an acquired drive, very like a hunger for food. So if you don't smoke, just think about yourself being very, very hungry for food. That then creates, obviously, what can seem to the person quite an overpowering urge to smoke. That's one thing. A second thing is that nicotine forms links in the brain between the situations in which you smoke and the act of smoking. So even smokers who don't necessarily smoke every day, if they smoke in particular situations, they experience an impulse to smoke in those situations. It feels like a behavioral addiction, but actually it's completely attributable to the fact that nicotine causes release of dopamine in a part of the brain that does this link forming. And then the third factor is that being humans, we form beliefs about things. And what happens when people don't smoke for a while is they start to experience withdrawal symptoms. And one of them is irritability. Another one is depression and anxiety. And then they smoke a cigarette and you get that feeling of relief. The smoker interprets that feeling as relief from stress. And they come to the belief that smoking helps with stress. It doesn't help with stress. It helps with the stress caused by not smoking because you're nicotine addicted. But that belief means that even months or years after you've stopped smoking, you encounter a stressful situation, your brain is thinking, aha, what shall I do? I'll smoke a cigarette. And that causes a lot of relapse.
The main, say, ways that perhaps people know of trying to quit are perhaps some of the over-the-counter type options, so things like gums and fake cigarettes and kind of menthol cigarettes. Mm. But these are traditionally thought to not have a very high success rate.
The problem is that nothing has a very high success rate. If your average smoker in England tries to stop, let's take 100 of them. By the time the year is out, 97 of them will be back to smoking if they try and do it without support or help. So that's the 3% success rate. And the vast majority of those will go back to smoking within the first week. Let's take the other end of the spectrum. With the very best support that medical science and psychology can provide, which is going to see a specialist who knows what they're doing to give you behavioral support, plus using one of the medications such as Champix or nicotine replacement therapy, you can boost that one-year outcome to 30%, right? That still means that 70% are going to fail, even with the very best that we can do. But the difference between 3% and 30% is a hell of a lot of lives saved.
Going down the pharmaceutical route, what are the, say, benefits of this? What does this actually do to the body to have such an improved success rate?
Let's start with the nicotine replacement products. You know, they do what they say on the tin. They replace nicotine. Now, a lot of people think, well, that doesn't make any sense. It's like giving alcohol to an alcoholic. But that's to misunderstand the way that nicotine works. Nicotine from a cigarette is delivered very rapidly through the pulmonary circulation to the brain, and it's that bolus, that sharp intake of nicotine, which is so addictive. You can think of it like crack cocaine versus chewing coca leaves. None of the nicotine products that we've got so far can mimic that or attempt to mimic that. The long and the short of it is that if you can simulate a cigarette in terms of pure nicotine delivery, then you can do a lot to overcome the cravings and the urges and so on. And to the extent that your nicotine delivery system is delivering the nicotine more slowly than a cigarette, people will find it relatively easy to come off those nicotine products. The other main drug is varenicline or Champix, and this was developed specifically as a nicotinic partial agonist, which binds to the receptors that are believed to be particularly relevant to nicotine addiction. And this particular drug is demonstrably more effective than, say, a single form of nicotine replacement like a patch, demonstrably more effective than its main competitor, which is a drug called Zyban, and it does get good success rates. It reduces the cravings by giving you a certain level of activity in the neural pathways concerned, but only up to a point, and that means that it is not in itself satisfying or positively reinforcing or rewarding, so you don't get dependent on it. But it's also binding very tightly and very efficiently to the receptors that nicotine would normally be on, and that blocks the nicotine from getting on those receptors. So if you do have a lapse and you have a cigarette, then there's nowhere for the nicotine to go in the brain, and so it's not so satisfying, so it's less likely to lead to full relapse.
So how successful, say, has this been? And would you say, therefore, that this type of drug is the way forward in treating addiction?
I think it's part of the way forward. I think there's a number of issues that always comes up. If a majority of smokers were to use this drug to help them stop, we would see smoking prevalence plummet because they would succeed. So in that sense, it's, you know, definitely part of the solution. Having said that, not everybody wants to use a medicine. All medicines have side effects. The main one from this one is nausea, but it also has an effect on sleep, causing sleep disturbance. And so where it comes back to in terms of the solution is that we have to bear in mind there's other things that one can do apart from take drugs to help with behavioral problems and addictions. Behavioral support of the kind that we have in our English Stop Smoking Services or UK Stop Smoking Services makes a big difference. And there's a lot of research, and we're doing some of it, on other very cost-effective solutions such as internet sites, smartphone applications. I think the answer lies in trying to get as many people to be confident enough to try to stop as often as they can, and then every time they do so, to look at what's available and make a judgment about what they think is the thing that's going to be best suited to them. And in many cases, that will be a prescribed medication. In other cases, it may be an internet site or a smartphone app.
Robert West from University College London. And now, further developments with the wonder material known as graphene. Philip?
Yes, Mira. I mean, regular listeners of the podcast will be fairly familiar with graphene by now. It's the single layer sheets of graphite carbon in six-membered rings. Looks a bit like chicken wire. But what we're talking about here is making little shapes out of graphene, because if you want to make a circuit, for example, you want long, thin strips to make the wires, or if you want to probe how the shape of the graphene dictates its electronic properties, you want to try and make specific shapes. And what Yali Li and his group at Tianjin University in China have done is do the first thing. They've made long strips by taking carbon nanotubes, flattening them, and sort of slicing them in half. So you take a cylindrical tube, squash it like ironing the sleeve of a shirt, and then slit down the kind of folded edges.
And it's as simple as that?
Yeah, pretty much. The key to this research was to make big enough carbon nanotubes so that they kind of collapse under their own weight and flatten out. And then there are several quite well-established ways of kind of unzipping these flattened nanotubes. And the method that this group used was just to use acid oxidation, which gives you some nice, flat and well-defined ribbons of graphene, but they're able to do it on a much larger scale and with much better purity and reproducibility.
And as well as this way, say, of making graphene, there's also been developments in ways to make nanographene.
Well, yes. I mean, rather than just sort of ribbons, we're talking about really, really tiny fragments of graphene. Whether you can call them graphene or not is a bit of a debated point. But what Kenichiro Itami is doing with his group at Nagoya University in Japan is using organic synthesis to build up really tiny sort of fragments of graphene from widely available polyaromatic hydrocarbons.
And so how is this actually done, and is it quite an easy method to make it?
Well, yes, there's several groups working on this kind of thing, but what Itami's group have done is remove a lot of the steps that you need to do. So you can just take a polyaromatic hydrocarbon like pyrene, which has four benzene rings all fused together in a kind of diamond shape, and just straight off react it with a biphenyl compound and a metal catalyst to sort of extend the number of rings and then do another oxidation reaction to flatten the whole thing out and join it all up together. And that gives you a sort of tiny little strip of what starts to look like a fragment of graphene.
What could you do with this?
Well, there's a certain amount of evidence that says that it's the shape of the edges of fragments of graphene that dictate their electronic properties. So by starting with different aromatic hydrocarbons, you can make different edge shapes, which then allows you to kind of probe the properties. And one of the big questions that I think Itami's group is trying to solve is how many rings do you need to make before it actually starts behaving like bulk graphene?
So essentially just kind of piecing the puzzle together in various ways until you find what you want.
Yeah, and that's where the simplicity of the organic chemistry that they've developed comes in, because you don't have to do lots of pre-functionalisation of the rings. You can just kind of bolt them together. So it allows you to make a whole variety of different shapes.
And we'll piecing nanographene together to piecing sugar together in a network, Phil.
That's right. And then building around that network some artificial tissue or organs. That's what we're talking about here, tissue engineering. So if you want to build some artificial tissue or an artificial organ, for example, that's simple enough. You can start with some cells in a petri dish, for example. But of course, in order to mimic the way that cells grow in the body, you need to have some kind of network to supply those cells with the nutrients that they need to grow and develop. And that's not so easy to do. People have tried to do this previously in various different ways, but the real struggle comes in trying to do this in a way that's that mimics the way that it happens in the body, the kind of vascular networks that you have in the body.
And so how are sugars enabling this?
Well, these sugars are being used to build a three-dimensional scaffold around which you can create these tissues and these organs. So this work has been carried out by Christopher Chen at the University of Pennsylvania in the US and his colleagues, and they used a 3D printer to print sugar, a lattice of sugar, effectively, so a kind of three-dimensional cubic network of sugar strands. And then around that, they placed cells in a sort of polymer matrix. And once the whole thing had been left to set, effectively, they could then dissolve away the sugar network simply using water to leave channels within the polymer cell matrix through which the nutrients can pass to feed the cells.
And now I guess they've shown that this is possible, so what next?
Chen thinks that in the future you could easily just pull off the appropriate file to get a network that you can then print out for heart tissue or some other organ, and then build the organ, build the tissue to be put into a patient. But the big challenge for them at the moment is to make their networks more closely resemble those that you would find in the body. So that's going to be the challenge, is to try and create something that looks a bit more like that.
I guess also to print out things like that.
That's a challenge for the engineers there, yeah, absolutely.
Okay, well, it's time to move on to this month's trivia, Phil, which we're continuing with the Olympics theme, but away from medals this month.
That's right. So my question this month is, how are the Olympics like a ready meal?
The food served there might be quite cheap and tasteless.
That's not bad. But there is another way in which they're similar, and that's what they come wrapped in. So your ready meals, they'll commonly be wrapped in polymer, a polyolefin polymer. And the stadium, the Olympic Stadium, thanks to Dow, the Dow Chemical Company, is also going to be wrapped in a polyolefin polymer wrap to finish, to go all the way around the edge of the stadium.
And how much, I guess, will it be wrapped in?
So the size of this wrap is a bit larger than your average ready meal. You're looking at about 21,000 square metres in total, actually, divided into 336 individual panels. That also actually serve a purpose to indicate the stands and seats so that the spectators can find where they're supposed to be. And, of course, to abide by the London 2012 Olympics sustainability criteria, after the Olympics, the wrap is going to be repurposed. Though they don't say quite what for. Perhaps they'll just use it to wrap a lot of ready meals.
And perhaps linking your ready meals with Olympic athletes will now get you exercising more. No? Just a thought. Thank you, Phil, and to the rest of the Chemistry World team this month, Philip Broadwith and Laura Howes. And also to our guests, Andrew Harrison and Robert West. Production this month was by me, Mira Senthilingam. Don't forget that you can follow up on the items you've heard here on the podcast via the Chemistry World website at chemistryworld.org. That's it for this time. We're back with more cutting-edge chemistry next month. But for now, goodbye.
The Chemistry World podcast is brought to you by the Royal Society of Chemistry. Look us up online at chemistryworld.org.